a Persian soldier survived Plataea. He was found 3 days after the battle, wandering the marshes near the Asopus River. No weapon, no armour. He was one of maybe 300 men left from an army that had numbered in the hundreds of thousands. He never spoke about what he saw inside that camp. His name doesn't appear in any record. The Greeks didn't bother writing it down. That detail, that erasure, tells you everything about what happened at Plataea. You know the story of 300 Spartans who held a mountain pass and died to the last man. You've seen the statues, you've heard the speeches. Come back with your shield, or on it. The hot gates, Leonidas, the ultimate sacrifice. What you haven't been told is what came after, because here's what actually happened. 11 months after Thermopylae, the Spartans returned. Not 300 of them, 10,000, and they didn't come to die beautifully. They came to collect a debt in a currency the Persian Empire had never encountered before. The Battle of Plataea, fought in the summer of 479 BC, ended with so many Persian bodies that ancient sources describe the fields as being impassable for days. And yet, almost nobody talks about it. Thermopylae has a film, statues, a cultural afterlife that spans 2,500 years. Plataea gets a paragraph in most history textbooks. Sometimes less. There's a reason for that. Cultures preserve what they want to remember. The Greeks wanted to remember the sacrifice, the loss that looked like nobility. What they were slower to memorialize was the part where they won, completely, totally, and with a precision that left the Persian Empire unable to mount another invasion of mainland Greece for the rest of its history. If you've been watching this channel and you haven't subscribed yet, this is the video that'll make you regret waiting. Hit subscribe and the bell right now. Every few days, we pull stories like this one out of the footnotes. The chapters historians cleaned up, left out, or decided weren't useful enough to remember. You don't want to miss what's coming. Now, back to Plataea, and the part that changes how you see Thermopylae entirely. We are going to walk through that story. Not the version where Greeks are heroes and Persians are villains. The actual version, the one with mud and starvation and commanders who couldn't agree on anything, and a single stone thrown at the right moment that changed the course of Western civilization. Let's start from the moment the legend ended and the reality began. 3 days after Thermopylae, Xerxes walked the battlefield. He found Leonidas's body among the Greek dead. Herodotus tells us what happened next. Xerxes ordered the head cut off and mounted on a stake. The body was crucified. Now hold that image for a moment, not for the horror of it, but for what it tells us about Xerxes' state of mind. Persian kings did not typically desecrate enemy commanders. Cyrus the Great had ordered honorable burials for his opponents. Darius I had done the same. Mutilation of a fallen king's body was not Persian protocol, it was personal. Leonidas and his 300 had cost Xerxes somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 men. The numbers in ancient sources vary, but even the lowest estimates are staggering. To hold a pass that should have been overrun in hours, the delay had allowed the Greek fleet to maneuver at Artemisium. It had bought Athens time to evacuate. It had, in ways Xerxes couldn't fully calculate yet, changed the architecture of the entire war. The desecration of the body was an answer to that humiliation. It was also a message to every Greek city-state that was still watching, still undecided. This is what resistance gets you. The message landed, but not the way Xerxes intended. The Persian army rolled south. Athens already evacuated on the advice of the Athenian commander Themistocles was occupied within weeks. The temples on the Acropolis, the Parthenon's predecessor, the treasury buildings, the sacred precincts of Athena were burned to the ground. This was not incidental looting. Persian commanders ordered the systematic destruction of sacred sites as a matter of policy. It was the ancient equivalent of burning a nation's identity. The physical city was ash. But there's something that happens when you burn a city whose population is still alive and watching from ships in the harbour. You don't destroy their will, you concentrate it. Here's what most documentaries skip. The Greek alliance almost dissolved completely after Thermopylae. Sparta and its Peloponnesian allies had a plan. Build a wall across the Isthmus of Corinth, fortify it, let Persia have everything north of that line, Athens included, and defend only the Peloponnese. The Spartan view was strategically defensible. The Isthmus was narrow. The Spartans were the best land army in the world, and they could hold that position indefinitely. The Athenians, floating on their fleet with nowhere to go, had a different perspective on this plan. Themistocles delivered an ultimatum that ancient sources describe as stunning in its directness. If Sparta and the Peloponnesian League refused to fight for mainland Greece, Athens would sail its entire fleet, the largest in the Greek world, west to Sicily. They would found a new city, they would leave. And without the Athenian fleet, Persia's navy could simply sail around the Isthmus wall and land troops anywhere in the Peloponnese it chose. The alliance didn't dissolve, but this exchange tells you the texture of what Pausanias was walking into when he took command. A coalition held together by mutual threat as much as shared purpose. The number you need to hold in your head is not 300. The number is 5,000. 5,000 Spartiates, full Spartan citizen soldiers, marched north to Plataea. This was not a ceremonial force. This was the mobilization of virtually the entire Spartan warrior class, an event that had no precedent in Spartan history. Sparta had never committed this many of its core soldiers to a single campaign outside its borders. Why does this matter? Because to understand what 5,000 Spartiates meant, you need to understand what a Spartiate was. A Spartan boy entered the Agoia, the state training system, at age 7. He left home. He slept in barracks. He was trained to handle pain, deprivation, cold, and prolonged discomfort as a baseline condition of life. For 13 years, he learned to fight, to move as a unit, to hold a shield wall under pressure that would cause most human beings to break and run. The Agogi had a dropout rate. Boys who couldn't make it became Perioesi, free Laconians who fought alongside Spartans, but were not Spartiates. The boys who completed it became something the ancient world treated as a category apart from ordinary soldiers. Each of those 5,000 was flanked by approximately 7 helots, agricultural labourers who served as light infantry and support. Conservative estimates put the total Spartan Laconian contingent at Plataea at around 40,000 people. Add to this 8,000 Athenian hoplites, 5,000 Corinthians. Contingents from Tegea, Megara, Phlius, Troezen, Hermione, Epidaurus, Orchomenos, Sicyon, and dozens of smaller city-states. The Hellenic League at Plataea was, by the accounting of Herodotus, somewhere between 80,000 and 110,000 men. The commander of this force was Pausanias. He was not a king, he was a regent, ruling on behalf of Leonidas's young son, Pleistarchus, who was too young to command. His uncle had died at Thermopylae, with a spear in him and his head on a stake somewhere in a Persian camp. Ancient sources give us very little about Pausanias's interior life at this point. What we have are his decisions, and his decisions tell us he was operating under a specific kind of pressure that has no modern equivalent. He was responsible for avenging a dead king, managing a fractious multi-city coalition, and defeating the largest army ever assembled in the Western world, all simultaneously. He marched his force north to the foothills of Mount Cithaeron, near the small Boeotian town of Plataea, and took up a position on elevated, broken ground. Across the Asopus River, on the flat plains below, Mardonius was waiting. Mardonius was not a fool. He was a veteran commander who had served Darius I, survived a catastrophic storm off the coast of Athos that destroyed 300 ships under his watch and rebuilt his career. He was related to the royal family by blood and marriage. He had pushed for this campaign aggressively. Some ancient sources suggest it was largely his idea. But Mardonius had a problem that no amount of tactical competence could solve. He had an army that was enormously effective on flat open ground. His cavalry, Bactrian, Persian, Thessalian, was possibly the best in the world. His Persian infantry, particularly the Immortals, were among the most disciplined soldiers alive. But the Greeks had chosen the hills, and Mardonius couldn't make them come down. So, for 11 days, nothing decisive happened. 11 days. That's not a dramatic detail. That's the reality of ancient warfare. Two massive armies staring at each other across a river, waiting for the other one to make a mistake. What we're about to get into is the sequence of events that turned this standoff into the bloodiest single day of the Greco-Persian Wars. And it starts not with a charge or a battle cry, but with a water supply, because the thing that broke the standoff at Plataea was thirst. Stay with me. The Greek position near Cithaeron had one major vulnerability, a single spring called the Gargaphian Spring, which supplied water to the entire army. Mardonius knew this. His cavalry began systematic harassment of Greek supply lines, intercepting convoys coming through the mountain passes, burning food, fouling smaller water sources. This wasn't battlefield maneuvering, it was attrition. He was trying to starve and dehydrate an army of over 80,000 people into abandoning its position. It was working. The cavalry commander who led many of these raids was named Mecistius, described by Herodotus as the most admired man in the Persian army, physically enormous, armored in a gold-scaled breastplate under his outer garments. In one engagement near the Greek lines, his horse was struck by an arrow and threw him. Mecistius landed and was surrounded by Athenians. They couldn't kill him at first. The gold-scaled armor deflected everything. It was only when someone stabbed through the visor of his helmet that he went down. The Greeks paraded his body on a cart along their lines. Herodotus says the sight had a visible effect on morale. Soldiers broke from their positions to look at the body of a man who had seemed invincible 48 hours before. The Persians, when they saw his body displayed, cut their horses' manes in mourning. The sound of the Persian camp that day, according to Herodotus, was grief rather than preparation. Small thing. But these small things accumulate. Then Mardonius's cavalry did something decisive. They found the Gargaphian spring and destroyed it, collapsed the banks, threw in debris, made it unusable. A few days later, a supply convoy coming through the Cithaeron passes was intercepted and burned. 80,000 men, no water, no incoming food. Pausanias called a council. The decision that came out of that council was the correct strategic decision and nearly a catastrophic disaster simultaneously. They would execute a night withdrawal to a secondary position closer to Plataea itself, which had better water access. The army would move in three columns: Spartans and Tegeans on the right, Athenians on the left, the rest of the Greek allies in the center, falling back toward the town. Night movements with armies of this size in the ancient world were genuinely dangerous. There were no radio communications, no GPS coordinates, no standardized signals beyond horns and torches. Moving 80,000 men in the dark, in three separate columns, without losing cohesion, required every commander at every level to do exactly what they were supposed to do at exactly the right time. That is not what happened. One Spartan commander refused. His name was Amompharetus, and he commanded Alochos, a unit of Spartiate soldiers. When the withdrawal order came, he picked up a large stone with both hands, dropped it at Pausanias's feet, and said, according to Herodotus, that this was his vote on the question of retreating from the enemy. He wasn't going. What followed was an argument conducted in whispers, in the dark, while the rest of the army was already beginning to move. Pausanias couldn't leave Amompharetus and his men behind. Abandoning Spartiates on a battlefield, even a battlefield where nothing was currently happening, was not something Spartan culture permitted. But every minute spent arguing was a minute the withdrawal was delayed and the plan was unravelling. The argument lasted until almost dawn. Eventually, Amonpharetus moved slowly at the rear of the Spartan column, making clear, through every action, that he considered this a retreat and was registering his contempt for it while technically complying with the order. By the time Pausanias got his force moving, the Athenians on the left were also confused. They'd received conflicting signals and were waiting for clarification that wasn't coming. The Allied centre had mostly completed their withdrawal. The Greek army, which was supposed to pull back as a coordinated force, was now scattered, the centre near Plataea, the Athenians somewhere in between, and the Spartans and Tegeans still threading their way down from the heights, separated from everyone else. And across the river, Mardonius had cavalry scouts who had been watching all of this. Dawn broke, and Mardonius looked across the Asopus. The Greek camp was partially empty. The heights were half abandoned. Scattered formations were moving in apparent disorder. From where he stood, what he was looking at appeared to be a panicked retreat, an army breaking up and fleeing. He crossed the river. It was the last major decision of his life. The Persian cavalry hit the Spartan rearguard first. Amonpharetus's unit, still moving slowly, still making a point. The Spartan column halted. Pausanias sent a runner to the Athenians. "We need you on our right." The Athenians started moving toward the Spartans and ran directly into the Theban hoplites fighting for Persia, who had been advancing on the left. The Athenians had their own fight. The Spartans were alone. What happened next is one of the most documented and debated sequences in ancient military history, because Herodotus describes something that doesn't quite make sense on the surface. Pausanias ordered his men to hold position and wait while the Persian arrows came in. He was waiting for omens. Specifically, he was waiting for the sacrifice of a goat to produce favourable signs. The Tegeans, positioned right next to the Spartans, apparently could not maintain this posture. They were taking casualties. They advanced without orders, and then the omens were favourable, and Pausanias ordered the advance. The Spartan phalanx in motion is something that ancient sources struggle to describe in ways that fully communicate what it meant to be standing on the receiving end of it. Picture approximately 5,000 men in tight formation, each carrying a large circular shield, the aspis, interlocked with the shield of the man on his left. Each man is armoured in bronze. Each carries a spear roughly 7 feet long. The formation is typically 8 ranks deep, meaning there are men pushing from behind at every point of contact. The formation advances at a walk, not a run. Ancient phalanxes didn't charge at full sprint. You don't maintain a shield wall at a dead run. They advance steadily, under control, adjusting to terrain, keeping the line. They walked into the Persian infantry. Persian soldiers were not poorly equipped or poorly trained. Their infantry carried wicker shields, shorter spears, and bows. They were effective in open battle under the right conditions, particularly when cavalry could screen their flanks and archers could thin an enemy formation before contact. What they were encountering was a formation that didn't thin when you shot arrows at it, because the shields overlapped and the men were armoured, and the formation kept moving regardless of casualties because the men behind kept pushing forward. The Persian infantry, including units of the Immortals, the Royal Guard, fought back with documented ferocity. Herodotus specifically says they grabbed at Spartan spears with their bare hands and broke them. They didn't break and run, they died in place. But they were dying. Mardonius was mounted on a white horse, surrounded by his 1,000-man royal bodyguard, the 1,000, fighting in the middle of the action. This was standard Persian royal military culture, the commander in the thick of it, visible to everyone, leading rather than directing from the rear. As long as Mardonius was visible and alive, the Persian line held. A Spartan hoplite named Arimnestus, mentioned by name in the ancient sources, which itself tells you the significance of what he did, spotted the Persian general through the chaos. He threw a stone, not a spear, a stone picked up from the ground thrown with whatever force he could generate. It struck Mardonius and knocked him from his horse. In the crush of fighting around him, the men of his royal guard unable to extract him, Mardonius was killed. The effect was immediate and visible. The Persian line, which had been holding, didn't hold anymore. Men who had been fighting with their hands against Spartan spears turned and ran. The phalanx pushed forward into the space where a defensive line had been. On the left, the story was different, but the outcome was the same. The Athenians were fighting Theban hoplites, Greeks who had chosen the Persian side. This was not a mismatch of equipment or training. These were hoplites fighting hoplites, the same formation, the same weapons, men who, in some cases, had trained alongside each other before the war divided them. The Thebans broke first. Their commanders, the leading families of Thebes who had committed to the Persian cause, led the retreat. The ordinary Theban soldiers, left without direction, followed. The Athenians pursued. The Persian army had a fortified camp on the Asopus, a large wooden stockade that had served as their base of operations for the entire campaign. When the battle broke, the survivors ran for it. The gates closed behind them. There were tens of thousands of men inside that enclosure. They had no commander. Mardonius was dead, his body somewhere on the field. The secondary commanders who survived were trying to hold a defence on walls that hadn't been designed for this situation. The Tegeans reached the stockade first, breached a section of wall, and got inside. The Athenians came next, tearing down sections of the wooden fortifications with the systematic efficiency of men who had been learning siege techniques since Salamis. Then the Spartans arrived. Herodotus's description of what followed inside the camp is one of the places where ancient sources go briefly quiet, in a way that is itself information. He gives casualty estimates, vague ones, extraordinary ones, and moves on. The numbers he cites suggest that of the Persian force at Plataea, which he puts at 300,000, almost certainly an exaggeration, but even a third of that is staggering. Something like 3,000 survived. What we know concretely, the fighting inside the camp was not battle. It was slaughter. Men trapped with no formation, no leadership, and no exit. The Greeks entering from multiple breach points, filling the interior. The wood of the stockade was still burning in places when it was over. The looting of a Persian royal camp was unlike anything the Greek soldiers had encountered. Mardonius had been travelling with the apparatus of Persian royal luxury, tents with gold and silver fittings, couches, storage vessels, personal treasuries. The Spartan soldiers who broke into his personal quarters found furniture and tableware that, by their own accounts, they had no frame of reference for. Pausanias, according to Plutarch, ordered Mardonius's cooks to prepare a Persian royal meal, then had a Spartan meal prepared side by side and showed both to his officers. The contrast, he is reported to have said, was the reason Persia had come so far to take something the Persians didn't understand. Whether that story is true or embellished, the fact that it was told suggests something about how the Greeks processed what they found. Abundance so extreme it read as decadence. The treasure from Plataea was distributed according to Greek practice. A tenth went to the sanctuary at Delphi, a tenth to Zeus at Olympia. The rest was divided among the allied cities. Sparta's share made it, for a time, the wealthiest city-state in mainland Greece. Ancient sources, Herodotus, Diodorus Siculus, make a claim that historians have debated for two millennia. On the same day Plataea was decided, the Greek fleet destroyed the remnants of the Persian navy at the Battle of Mycale, off the coast of Anatolia, the same day. This is almost certainly a piece of mythologizing, coordinating a naval battle in Asia with a land battle in Boeotia, on the same day, with no modern communications, strains probability. But the fact that the Greeks told the story this way tells you something. They needed the ending to be total, simultaneous. A single moment when everything changed at once. The war didn't end at Plataea in a legal sense. Skirmishes continued. The Greek League would campaign in the Aegean for years. Persia didn't formally acknowledge the independence of the Greek city-states until the Peace of Callias, decades later. But Persia never sent another army to mainland Greece, not in the reign of Xerxes, not in the reign of any subsequent Achaemenid king. That line was drawn in the mud outside Plataea on a morning in August 479 BC, when a stone thrown by a man named Arimnestus struck a general named Mardonius and ended the last invasion. The 300 at Thermopylae held a pass for 3 days. The Greeks at Plataea held a civilization. The reason one of those stories gets the statues and the films, and the other gets a footnote, is a question worth sitting with. History doesn't remember what's most important, it remembers what's most useful. Thanks for watching. If this is the kind of history you want to see, the parts that don't get cleaned up, subscribe and join the community. Drop in the comments, what other battles do you think history got wrong about which side was truly the more dangerous one?